Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, I'll be bringing you part 12 in our series by the ambitious title of The Vatican Centuries. I'll be marking the day the Catholic Church celebrates the feast of Januarius, a popular Neapolitan saint, and sharing with you some exclusive insight into the artwork in the Sistine Chapel. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again, this time for part 12 of the Vatican Centuries, in which we'll be continuing our journey back in time to rediscover some of the lives and legends of the people and places that went into the making of the Vatican down the centuries. A series written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. So while last week we heard how Christianity in Britain revived after Gregory the Great sent Augustine as missionary, and also how St. Bede recorded visits of those first English pilgrims here in Rome, today we hear how the growing English colony settles near St. Peter's. Stay tuned.
Throughout the 7th and 8th centuries, the pilgrims flocked to Rome to gaze at the splendours of St. Peter's, a Byzantine building glittering with mosaics and rich in golden candelabra.
But for the English pilgrim, the Vatican meant not only St. Peter's, but another, more homely spot. Only a few minutes' walk away from the great basilica stood a cluster of wooden Saxon houses, witness to the ever-growing English colony, and known familiarly as the Borgo.
One of the characteristics of the Anglo-Saxon Church was its close union with Rome and a great devotion to St. Peter. Kings and queens in particular were impressed by St. Peter's function as doorkeeper of heaven. "If Peter is the doorkeeper," said King Oswy of Northumbria, "I will in all things obey his decrees, lest when I come to the gates of the kingdom of heaven there be none to open them."
Many are the royal saints of Anglo-Saxon England. The calendar of the Anglo-Saxon Church contained over 300 canonised saints, of whom more than half were of royal birth. 26 English kings and queens left their court for the cloister, while numerous others came to Rome to end their lives as close as possible to Peter's tomb.
Only 20 years after the dramatic death in Rome of the newly baptised king of the West Saxons, Cadwalla, two other English monarchs followed his path to the Eternal City.
In 709, Conrad, king of the Mercians, renounced his throne, came to Rome to live as a monk, and at his death was buried near Cadwalla in St. Peter's. His companion pilgrim was Offa, king of the East Saxons, who likewise became a monk and was buried in St. Peter's at his death in 794.
Offa is also remembered for the institution known familiarly as Peter's Pence. At the Synod of Chelsea in 787, Offa promised an annual donation to the Pope. Some years later, he went to Rome to discuss arrangements for the monastery of St. Albans, which he'd recently founded. On that occasion, he gave a silver penny from every family in the kingdom whose arable land was over a certain value.
Of these two kings and of another English king who left in Rome a permanent memorial, Bede the historian writes.
Conrad, who had ruled the kingdom of Mercia with great renown for some while, resigned his kingly sceptre for a yet more noble kingdom. During the pontificate of Constantine, he went to Rome, received the tonsure, and became a monk at the Shrine of the Apostles, passing the remainder of his days in prayer, fasting, and acts of mercy. With Conrad went Offa, a very handsome and lovable young man whom the entire nation greatly hoped would inherit and uphold the scepter of the kingdom. But, fired by an equal ardor, he left his wife, lands, family, and country for the sake of Christ and his gospel, hoping to receive an hundredfold in this life, and in the world to come, life everlasting. So when they had arrived at the holy places in Rome, he received the tonsure, entered upon the monastic life, and at last attained the long-desired vision of the blessed apostles in heaven.
Bede also tells us of a king and queen who came to end their days in Rome.
On Cadwallader's departure for Rome, he was succeeded as king by Ina, who was of the blood royal. Having ruled the nation for 37 years, Ina also abdicated and handed over the government to younger men. He then set out to visit the shrines of the blessed apostles during the pontificate of Gregory II, wishing to spend some of the time of his earthly pilgrimage in the vicinity of the holy places, hoping thereby to merit a warmer welcome from the saints in heaven. At this period, many English people followed this custom, both noble and simple, lay folk and clergy, men and women alike.
When Ina and his queen Ethelberga came to Rome about the year 720, they renounced the world and lived in evangelical poverty until their deaths about 728. They're said to have died blessing God that he allowed them to lay their dust in the consecrated soil of Rome.
Ina is remembered in Rome for what he left to posterity. He erected a church for the pilgrims of his country who came to pray at Peter's tomb. The church was named Our Lady of Saxia, or Our Ladies in the Anglo-Saxon Quarter. Ina also built a house which served as hotel, hospice, dormitory, hospital and cemetery. This kind of institution was known as a scola, meaning a guild or fraternity. King Ina also imposed on his distant subjects the tax or tribute of a silver coin that Offa had promised the Pope. This was to be paid by every wealthy family and sent to Rome for the upkeep of the scola. The tax was called Rome's Cot. It's uncertain where Ina and his queen were buried, maybe in the church he built, now replaced by another, or maybe under the portico of old St. Peter's.
In the 8th and 9th centuries, the district around the church and hospice came to be known as the Burgus Saxonum, from the Saxon word burg. To this day, the streets of the area are known as Borghi.
On several occasions, the Borgo caught fire. The Anglo-Saxons in Rome were a careless lot. Contemporaries held that the fires were probably due to their slothfulness. But the popes were more considerate to the inefficient foreigners. In the fire of 817, Paschal I himself intervened. He was most concerned when he heard of the fire and rushed immediately to the spot, barefoot and only half-dressed. He managed to encourage the community to get the fire under control. Then he gave them money, food and clothing, together with supplies of timber for rebuilding, all out of his own pocket.
Listening there to part 12 of The Vatican Centuries, a series written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. You can hear the next in this series at the same time next week. And now I'd like to mark the feast day of Saint Januarius in an effort to find out more about popular devotion to this martyr of the faith, whose relics and blood are carefully guarded under lock and key within Naples Cathedral. Blood, which, as we know, allegedly liquefies 3 times a year, an event witnessed and described by many English writers over the centuries, from Charles Dickens to more recently H.V. Morton. I've asked Sean Patrick Lovett to read you a passage from H.V. Morton's A Traveller in Southern Italy. Let's listen.
The church is built upon the site of a temple of Apollo, and those Neapolitans fortunate enough to be christened there receive baptism at a huge basalt urn decorated with Bacchanalian symbols, which is said to have come from a temple of Dionysus. In this perhaps appropriate pagan setting, the head and blood of St. Januarius are kept in an ornate chapel, glittering with gold, silver, and precious marbles. A red brocade curtain conceals the silver doors of a safe behind the altar, which can be unlocked only by several keys, which are in the keeping of different officials. Inside is the Palladium of Naples, the phial containing a hard brown substance said to be the blood of St. Januarius, who was martyred in the year AD 305. 3 times a year, upon the first Sunday in May, upon September 19th and December 16th, in the course of a noisy ceremony, the saint's blood generally liquefies, and sometimes turns red, and appears, as many have said who have seen it, to boil. The reliquary is circular, and in size and shape is like a hand mirror. Clear glass back and front protects, and also reveals 2 ancient phials inside, which contain the sacred blood. I wondered how many of us, if we came across this reliquary in the window of a curiosity shop, would give it a second glance. The substance has never been chemically examined, therefore no one really knows whether it is truly blood or something else.
Now, while my thanks go to Sean Patrick Lovett for reading that passage from H.V. Morton's A Traveller in Southern Italy for us, I'd like to share with you an interview focusing precisely on this phenomenon of liquefaction. I do that with Jesuit Father Pietro Michele Garofalo, who's Neapolitan born, of course. Father, Neapolitans have a particular devotion to St. Januarius, or San Gennaro, as you call him in Naples. He's their patron saint. They pray to him for protection from earthquake, eruptions of Vesuvius, and for all kinds of personal reasons. It's a devotion linked to the blood of San Gennaro, preserved in 2 glass phials in the city's cathedral. Can you explain?
Oh, yes. The so-called the sign, this spiritual sign or miracle, it depends on how people might say. Cardinal Ursi, years ago, when he was the Cardinal of Naples, he might call it a sign. There are 2 files, that's right, 2 files, but really, generally they say one, because one, really, in one there is a lot of blood or solid material. After, say, 2 minutes, half an hour, 2 hours, it melts. And the way in which it melts is never is exactly the same, because generally, you see, on September the 19th, when really it started, because it's the day St. Januarius was beheaded, the other small file is really very small, of different qualities, but there are some, you know, say, some drops. But really, in one file, it takes place, and there have been endless investigation about it.
Well, as you've just heard, Father Garofalo tells me there has been extensive scientific research surrounding this phenomenon down the centuries. No analysis of the blood inside the phials has ever been carried out. That's forbidden for fear the phials might break. Taking place several times a year on the days linked in a particular way to San Gennaro and carefully documented in a diary since 1659, hidden away inside the cathedral, this phenomenon is a complex one, he insists. But it does have a pattern to it.
It runs for 8 days.
You mean the blood stays liquid for 8 days?
That's right. It becomes liquid in different ways, because sometimes it looks, it's boiling, it's very red. I have seen it.
But it doesn't always happen, does it?
Oh, no, it's connected with the famine, with plague, with the eruption of the Vesuvius. When the eruption of Vesuvius took place, I mean, the miracle didn't happen.
Which would explain why a people who live at the foot of a volcano like Vesuvius are keen to make sure the blood of San Gennaro does liquefy. Although Father Garofalo does add that beyond this phenomenon, Neapolitans are anyway people with strong faith. But I wondered, where does this event actually take place?
Generally, extraordinary fact. It takes place in the chapel. And there, behind the altar, where the blood is kept, the bishop, the cardinal, takes into and people begin pray.
The miracle takes place in the presence of the hierarchy and occurs whatever the weather. The only thing that changes is the time it takes for the liquefaction to occur.
It's unexplainable, in other words. So that's why they call it a miracle, because it goes beyond knowledge. There are cases in which the blood, when it stops, it may stop even obliquely, and it may last, say, half an hour, 2 hours, with this different kind of weather. It doesn't depend from the weather, it doesn't depend on anything. Everything what had been, it goes beyond our reasoning.
Out of curiosity, I asked if the files were shown to the faithful and if candles were used to light this process. Once again, the fear of breaking the files surfaced. Candles are forbidden, I was told.
They use an electric torch in order to show in a better way for the people, because the cardinal goes around in order to show that people can kiss and see moving, and they can see quite clearly that their blood is really moving, and it is really blood. The strange thing for people who want to rationalize too much is the fact that, why on earth this takes place all the time? It becomes like a spectacle. It becomes like a show. Some people might say that God gives us, to the Neapolitans, the possibility that it doesn't give to others in a way.
So this is a miracle rather than just a popular devotion.
It's a miracle. It's a miracle and public devotion as well, of course. It's public devotion. But the public devotion is focused, is helped by the miracle.
Can you place the devotion into its historical context? Who was Januarius San Gennaro?
San Gennaro, he was the bishop of Benevento, but he was born in Naples. Why was he killed, was beheaded in Pozzuoli, near Pozzuoli? Because he went there to visit some of his friends who were taken into prison. And once he discovered that he too was taken into prison, and then a little process and condemned.
So he was a persecuted Christian and became a martyr?
Yes, it was the hardest persecution at the time. It was the persecution of the Diocletian between 303, 305. We don't know exactly if this happened in 303 or 304. This was the period in which really the persecution hardened all over the places. People should come and see. You see, this is really very important, because otherwise, words do not give the right impression. One has to see and, of course, then organize, read about it in order to understand, this extraordinary event, because it's an extraordinary event.
And a big thank you there to Jesuit Father Pietro Michele Garofalo for enlightening us on this very Neapolitan devotion relating to the blood of Saint Januarius, which is kept in files in Naples Cathedral. A cathedral, by the way, visited by Pope Benedict XVI back in October 2007. Finally, why not go arty and join Professor of Fine Arts Breeder Ennis behind Vatican walls? We're looking at the Sistine Chapel once again. Mm-hmm. We're not looking at the Last Judgment. We go a little bit above that to the right of Jonah, I think. And we're going to look at that, the brazen serpent in one of the spandrels.
Yes, yes. Obviously, a person visiting the Sistine Chapel will be coming in from the door which is just below, just beside the high altar, and they won't be coming in from the main door. I often think it would be lovely sometime for people to have the possibility to walk in through the main door of the Sistine Chapel and to see it in its entirety and to have this extraordinary pictorial book painted on walls, but having this book open its pages before you and just reveal itself, reveal its secrets and reveal its messages. So again, if that was the case, you'd be looking up straight towards the high altar, and the person would look up the wall right across this Last Judgment fresco and go right up to the right-hand side into the spandrel, and just to the right of Jonah sitting on his throne, you find this marvellous piece called the Brazen Serpent theme, which relates to salvation, because all the pieces in the chapel, in the Sistine Chapel, relate to deciding which way you're going to go. A help to assist you in deciding which way to go, because there is the freedom element for the person. So salvation is expressed in the Sistine Chapel through many different pictorial elements, and this one here in particular is quite strong. It's actually visually and also from the point of view of what could be happening and on the physical point of view quite tough, because here you have Moses, who was ordered by God to put a brazen serpent coiled around a stick, and that anybody who looked at this particular serpent and was bitten would be saved. And all the others who were not saved on the right-hand side of this spandrel were bitten and died, bitten by green serpents who were quite vicious.
So Michelangelo used green paint for the evil snakes and gold for the good snakes. What does this relate to in the Bible story, Brida?
The story when the Israelites were in the wilderness and God, the Lord, sent fiery serpents to punish their disobedience. So, and this is where Moses was ordered to make a serpent of brass and set it on a pole. And those who looked at it were cured and saved. And those who were not, obviously, were killed. Now, this is supposed to symbolize the crucifixion itself. Some because it's coming in the Old Testament, obviously. As you can see now, it's a strange space that Michelangelo had to paint in, because it's almost like a V. So he's painting up and from the bottom, which is narrow, and going out wide on each side. So a person looking at this, on the left-hand side, you will see the people who are saved. They're dressed in red and green and with green sashes. And then they have bands. Some of them have these lovely headdresses too. You see a lady here who's holding out her hand. She has a headdress in a sort of a pale beige colour. And she's also wearing a pale beige dress. Well, that would have been actually white. It was sort of an off-white dress. Then behind you have the lilac. And then above, somebody else has a headdress in green. These lovely, luscious colours that you find also painted by Michelangelo in many of the Sibyls on the ceiling. So you find here some of this luscious use of colour that he used there. Blonde hair, dark hair, then he has hidden figures in behind figures. So he always uses tiny, unfinished figures to create a sense of depth in his painting. It's like the human beings are telling the story here. There's very little detail in relation to grass and ground and sea or whatever. You can see the brush strokes here, green and yellow and brown. And there's very little, let's say, earth. There's very little sky, but you have on the, and then you move over on the right hand side and you find all these swirling, vicious green serpents who are either squashing people or biting them on the face. Here, there's one on the extreme right. You can see one is being bitten literally on the mouth by a very ferocious looking snake. And then in the far right on the top, there's a snake that's trying to swallow a person. And look at this look of horror on the man's face, because the snake has grabbed him from behind, this green snake, and it's about to literally swallow him. And another one in front is being crushed. His legs are crushed and he's fallen on his back and he's trying to save himself, but the serpent is going for his mouth. then there's another figure just next to him who looks like in excruciating pain because the serpent is literally surrounding his entire body. And you see the man, he's dressed in orange and you see he has his arm around the snake trying to pull him off his body, which is an instinctive reaction. Just below him, there's a man already dead because obviously the skin colour is the colour of death. And you can see that the serpent has already killed that person. Then you see the head of another serpent about to go for the armpit of a person. And I can imagine the result of that being a ferociously big serpent. Then behind, you have people squashed and knowing that they're going to be next. And then you have this figure at the top, which is a strange-looking figure because he's dressed in violet and his hair is running in every direction, flowing brownish hair. And his mouth is open and he's looking with absolute horror at what's going on in front of him. So it's very strange. You have a sort of a tranquil kind of ethereal movement on the left side of the spandrel where the people who are saved are. It means that they're saved and they're all looking at the serpent in terms of the salvation. It's funny that in the Sistine Chapel, when you're talking about the saved and the damned, you always have few saved and a lot damned. You know, so it's again here he's emphasizing this, or the book of the good deeds and the book of the bad deeds being bigger and smaller, etc.
Rina, what do snakes symbolize traditionally in painting?
In classical painting, the serpent was a kind of symbol of time and also a symbol of eternity. So a lot of these older symbols from the past were also transformed and reutilized by Christians to be able to explain or give a message. Sometimes symbols can actually have different meanings. Because, for example, the snake we normally think of as evil, and you see many paintings of the Madonna who's crushing the snake with her feet. The case of the snake is the case where you have a symbol which actually has two meanings in two different situations. The saying, what is it, to be Christ himself who said, wise as serpents and as innocent as doves. Meaning, with to be quite prudent. So this kind of wisdom, meaning a knowledgeable wisdom. Michelangelo here, in this depiction of the brazen serpent, as you can see, he's using very few elements to be able to tell this story, but he's able to tell you this entire piece on its own, even if you knew nothing about what was happening. I mean, you didn't know the story itself and you're looking at it. You can see peaceful people on the left-hand side. You can see people who are distraught and desperate on the right-hand side. And you see this figure in the middle, which is the deciding, dividing factor.
And a big thank you there to our Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, for sharing with us her expertise in the field of sacred art. Breda is currently teaching at the American University of Rome. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. And be sure to check out our website. The address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.